Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What were you going to say about the list of medications?
Nothing. I was just, cause that's what the paper is more or less around too, right?
Not necessarily. Okay. So what we're going to talk about today with Dr. Walter from Cleveland Clinic is a paper that you wrote about how hospitals should be looking to administer medications to Parkinson's patients in the hospital setting. Is that
correct? That's correct.
Welcome to The Secret Life of Parkinson's, a podcast created by people living with Parkinson's to help break the stigma of a disease no one likes to talk about. Now, here are your hosts, Jessica Krauser and Brian Baker. Well, welcome.
Yeah, thank you.
We're glad to have you. Glad to have you on. Glad to finally meet you in person.
It's great to see the setup and meet you guys.
Yeah. Do you want to do a quick background on what you do with Cleveland Sure. Clinic and how long you've been there?
Yeah, so I'm a movement disorders neurologist. I've been in Cleveland practicing for 20 years at the Cleveland Clinic currently. I started the Cleveland Clinic. I spent some time in other places. Most of what I do is see people with Parkinson's and tremors and other movement disorders. I focus a lot on deep brain stimulation, but do research in some other areas, including looking at how the brain works with Parkinson's, with functional MRI. And another big area that is important to me is making sure that we just deliver good care for people with Parkinson's. And one of the biggest opportunities, I think, has been with hospitalization, where people have the biggest problems. We make people healthy and keep them well in our clinics. But where things really can unravel is when they're sick with other problems in the hospital.
So what do you see from, with the paper that you published? It, you know, you talk about, one, getting medications on time, getting the right medications, but really making sure that the hospital staff is aware. Has there been any movement to making sure that, how do we make sure that all these hospitals are aware? Because right now I know that they're not. They're not aware, I think, of the fact that Parkinson's patients need certain medications at specific times, and they don't know that there's medications that we should not be administered in the hospital.
It is a tremendous challenge. Yeah. It's complicated, and treating Parkinson's is complicated to begin with. The medications we use are complex. And when people get sick with Parkinson's, with other illness, what happens is complicated, and that makes it a very big problem. One issue is that when people are hospitalized, about 89% of the time, they don't get their meds right. They don't get them on time. They might not get the right dose. They might change or substitute doses because they can't get the exact formulation that they have and might make errors in how they do that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times they give contraindicated medications that make Parkinson's worse for different reasons because of issues that crop up during their hospitalization. Mm-hmm. So the awareness is a big part. We're working very closely with the Parkinson's Foundation.
I saw that.
To get the word out. And that's something that they've been working on for a long time as well. The challenge is when you're sick with Parkinson's, and again, you are in the hospital with some other illness, essentially. It's other doctors that are taking care of you. It's not your movement disorder right. specialist. You're not there for Parkinson's. Most people are hospitalized for other things. It's pneumonia. It's cancer. Mm-hmm. It's a heart problem. It's a fall or a fracture. One in four people with Parkinson's are hospitalized mm-hmm. every year. A pretty high number. And the longer you've had it, the more it is. So it's actually a lot more than that if you've had Parkinson's for a long time, particularly if you're older. So it happens a lot that you're going to be in the hospital. Mm-hmm. And again, the specialists that are seeing you are generally like an orthopedic surgeon or a general surgeon or an internist. And Parkinson's isn't what they do on a regular basis. So the awareness is one part. And you know, the Parkinson's Foundation has put out an aware and care kit, and now there's a whole booklet on hospitalization yep. that's brand new, has been revamped, and that's good for the awareness. What we're trying to do is a bit more direct and is also specific in our hospitals, where we're staffing the hospital with our team to screen everybody who gets admitted with Parkinson's disease. Mm. So we know... Now we're not waiting for something to go wrong. Mm-hmm. We're waiting for somebody with Parkinson's to come to the hospital.
Okay.
And when we see that, we look to see how their meds are being started, whether the prescription and the orders are correct. Mm-hmm. And we're looking to see if they have any problems so that we can correct those issues before the problems occur. Usually if you have an error in the medications, it's probably not going to be right away that you see ramifications. But in the next day or two, things may unravel, and we want to get to it before that happens.
So is that happening in all Cleveland clinics or just like the main campus or what?
Yes and no. So we're focusing on our main campus and one of our regional hubs, Fairview Hospital, with the direct intervention. But at the same time, we're constantly changing and iterating what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of our intervention is electronic based. It's mm-hmm. Intervention with the electronic health record itself. And so with that, it affects all Cleveland Clinic facilities across the world at the same time.
So it's more than just like a pilot program. Like you're piloting it essentially, but then it's also being dispersed amongst.
Yeah, it's a quality improvement, quality assurance program that we're also researching at the same time. And it is being studied in such a way that we're actively altering and improving the intervention as we go along.
Is there anything in the electronic health record? And I ask this because I still work part-time. I'm at a pharmaceutical consulting company, and one of the services that we offer pharma manufacturers is when they're coming to launch a new drug, and even for drugs that have been already approved and out there, we work with the what's called the compendia. And the compendia is like the data source for everything that feeds into the pharmacy, like for prescriptions. It feeds into the electronic health records. It feeds into government, like for Medicare, Medicaid, everything. And it's all the details about the drug. And that's where if there is like a drug-to-drug interaction, that mm-hmm. starts out at the compendia. And I've been working with the individual on my team to see like from, because there's the disease-to-drug interaction that we talked about.
Right.
I'm working with them to say like, how can we get that taken care of at the compendia level? Because the compendia feeds every single electronic health record, not just Epic, not just this one. It feeds all of them.
Absolutely.
So looking to fix that. But is that also where we can, like where, like could an electronic health record one day say, like if he's going into the hospital, it should say, this is, he needs his medication at these specific times. And it's like a red alert. Is that how it is today? Or is that how it can be?
Yeah, so you raised two really important points. So with regards to the drug-drug or drug-disease interactions, mm-hmm. So there are data sources that each electronic health record use, and there's some big ones in the United States that do most of them. A lot of times that level is turned off. In our system, drug-drug interactions are turned on, I think, in every electronic health record. Yeah. Drug-disease interactions are much more complex and challenging to implement and turn on because there are so many of them. It's a very diverse, complicated, and not always accurate record. And you have to have levels of severity. And then the question is, how far down do you want to go? Do you want just the most severe alerts, or do you want to go down to the ones below that? And so we looked at that. And, you know, fortunately, we were trying to get that implemented. The Cleveland Clinic was turning on drug disease interactions. This is in 2023 as well at the same time. So it was perfect timing. And we got to pilot a little bit before they went live. And when we looked at the interactions for Parkinson's at the highest level, there were a lot of first-generation antipsychotics, which should be contraindicated, but they're generally not used. So it didn't have a big impact because these are medications that were used a long time ago and aren't used as much anymore. And then there were some things that didn't quite belong on the list and some things that might have been more related to other similar diseases, but not necessarily Parkinson's. So it was, you know, some noise in the data there. And then some of the medications that really mattered a lot that we see a lot of use of were at lower levels. And so when our system turned on the highest level alert because they didn't want to overwhelm the clinicians, if you turn everything on, you're going to have all these pop-ups that come up and everybody's just going to start ignoring it, because of the fatigue of those alerts. So you have to be very careful to have just the right amount of alerts.
So, and this is a question I just don't know the answer to. So when, so if you put an order in for me at my cell, let's say you're going to give me levodopa 3 times a day at 8, 12, and 4, and you tell me 8, 12, and 4, I know that. But does, and I go to the hospital and they say, hey, Brian, we got your prescription pulled up here. It says you take this 3 times a day. It does not usually say 8, 12, or 4. It says 3 times a day.
This is the other big problem,
is
the timing, and then there's the dose. So with regards to that, generally speaking, when doctors write prescriptions, they're thinking in Latin, basically, QD, daily, BID, TID for 3 times a day. And those regimens are perfect for antibiotics and other things that are spread out evenly over time. It doesn't really apply correctly to the way people take Parkinson's medications. Generally, we're trying to keep even levels while people are awake. If you're more advanced, then you might need some coverage overnight. You might need less at night. And so it's very different. It's very individualized. And typically, what will happen if you're taking your meds 3 times a day, they're going to assume TID, which is every 8 hours, and they'll put you on the hospital schedule for that, and you're going to get it when the nurses pass the 3 times a day meds, which is not when you take your meds and not when you need it, because most of our meds do not last 8 hours, and particularly levodopa-based medications generally don't last 8 hours, even in early disease. They might last 6 hours in early disease. In a more advanced disease, it might last two, and you don't want to give the patient who takes their meds every 2 hours every 8 hours instead. You're going to have a lot of off time.
Yeah, so I saw that problem, and I also saw, you know, the nurses are just so running around.
Overwhelmed,
you know, for them to be on. You know, it's not easy for them to be on my schedule, you know, so that's the other thing, educating. I think it's some education on
that. So how can, are you, is that, but that is something you're trying to look into?
That is something as well that we're looking at. So with regards to the timing, you know, one challenge is that the electronic health records don't have a good time-based synchronization between outpatient meds and inpatient meds. Inpatient meds are databased on a time schedule because if you think about it, the nurses need to know what time to pass the meds. When it's a prescription at home, the patients take care of that. And generally, most medications aren't time-sensitive, but Parkinson's medications are. Mm-hmm. Diabetes medications are probably time sensitive, but it's related to when you eat as well. But there's nothing that's quite as time sensitive probably as Parkinson's medications.
Really? Okay, I was just going to ask.
It's one of the more complex ones.
Okay.
But we've been working with the electronic health records to come up with a way to start recording the outpatient meds for Parkinson's in a more time sensitive way, and also so that can be converted to the inpatient side.
Oh.
You can do it in prescriptions with free text, but to get it done right and actually have those times applied to that in a way that can be translated by a computer, it needs to be a little bit more specific. So that is something that's in the works with Epic in particular and okay. the other electronic records. Back to the other issue with regards to the compendia and the drug-disease interactions. So what we did is we had to go to the company that makes that data source. And first we got permission. We could edit what we had at the clinic because we had a higher level subscription. So we changed it to what we wanted. I said, well, that was nice, but that just helps us.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, well, what about everybody else? This shouldn't be like us. So they said, well, we have a petition process. If you are a subscriber, which we are, they welcome feedback, and you just have to make an appeal to change the data. So we wrote up and analyzed why it should be changed and what data supported it. And we got a quick response back from them, and they changed it. So right now for that particular data source, worldwide, it's now correct for Parkinson's disease.
Really? Is that like Medispan or First Data Bank?
First Data Bank.
Oh, great. Okay. So anybody, any of the EHRs that, but they have to have the disease to drug module on.
They have to have it turned on.
Yeah.
And again, you know, not all hospitals will have that turned on for the reasons the problems that it creates. But at least when they do, it will be correct for Parkinson's disease. And we have a lot of the appropriately contraindicated medications at the highest level.
Okay.
So that, you know, those medications. And we even saw in the interim, as we implemented our intervention, you could see when the advice was out there, but it wasn't quite precise.
Mm-hmm.
You could see a change in pattern of what people were ordering. But some things went down while other contraindicated meds went up because it almost gives permission to give a medication that people shouldn't get if it's not on the list.
Right.
And so getting that correct is really important.
But that's what you did.
We did. Yeah. We corrected it for for the entire data source.
That's great. Could it be replicated then to the other data sources?
Sure. Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
Okay.
Unfortunately, there's not too many of them. I think worldwide there's
like three or four.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I actually have connections to
the other ones.
All of, yes, I do. So I'm like, we're talking about this afterwards.
So we can do it. We can do it right now.
Yeah. Because I actually said, I know we're actually going to call my contact after this because that was the one thing. It's like, if there's one thing that I can change.
Why not fix them all?
I know. I'm like, the fact that it was like, I didn't even know about this issue with medications in the hospital until Dr. Patel told us last year. We had him on the podcast oh my God. I was like, he said it and I'm like, wait a minute, say that again. I'm like, there's medications in the hospital that we can't get, but doctors and nurses don't know about it. Like, how is this not in the EHR? And that's when I started at work. I started like digging into and asking all kinds of questions. So this is great. It sounds like you already got it changed. Like step one, big step changed. So thank you very much for doing that. Because what it should do, and hopefully, are you going to be able to track, or do you have somebody looking at it to say hospital incidences of, because the research I was doing is one in four patients or one in four people with Parkinson's are likely to go to the hospital setting. So we're likely to go there more. But even the fact that we're there because of the interactions from a drug standpoint, our hospital stay is longer.
Right.
Are you going to have somebody track that to see if that starts to come down because of the changes?
We are, and we'll have that data in a few days.
I'm so excited.
You're such a data nerd.
Shut up.
So this study that we've been doing started with a retrospective review prior to any of our major activities with this particular program. We started our inpatient program before we started studying it. So we had to go back before that, and we had to go back before COVID. So we went back to 2018 and took a data set from that year. Mm-hmm. We very carefully analyzed the data on how the timing of meds were for people with Parkinson's and also the contraindicated medication administration in the hospital. And we also specifically looked at people with Parkinson's of all types, not just idiopathic Parkinson's disease, but anybody that had a label of any form of Parkinson's or Parkinsonism other than secondary to antipsychotics or secondary drug-induced Parkinsonism, because with that, you're going to see a different signal as far as mm-hmm. you know, whether they're getting contraindicated medications, because that might be the cause, and they might have an underlying psychiatric illness and not really Parkinson's disease. And the reason for that is, you know, the specificity of the diagnosis in the hospital setting is not precise. And some of the people that are more vulnerable are people that sometimes are given an atypical label during that hospital stay, where their movement neurologist might have a different opinion. Okay. So we looked at all those people, and we carefully defined the relationship between the meds and the outcomes. And what we saw was that there's a strong relationship, and specifically the reference for this was what their home schedule was. Not what was ordered, because what we recognize, as you pointed out, that one of the biggest challenges is actually getting the order right in the first place. Mm-hmm. It's translating from what you are comfortable on and stable on to what they're ordering in the hospital, and then from the order it actually then translates to what's being administered, which is sometimes, at least from a time perspective, might be off even more so. So we're comparing the two ends of that, what the patient's home stable regimen is to what they were actually getting. Mm-hmm. And what we found was that if the levodopa dose is off, if the timing is off, that people had increased length of stay, they had increased mortality, mm-hmm. They had increased readmissions within 90 days as well. If they got contraindicated medications, the same thing. Very significant correlations between contraindicated medications and mortality and length of stay and readmissions. So we defined that very well in that population, looking back. Mm-hmm. And then we took the same analytical process and basically the same data set and then brought it to the present time with our intervention. And now we're screening in the two hospitals that we're studying all the people that get admitted with Parkinson's, mm-hmm. making sure that they're getting their meds ordered on time, that they're not having problems with it, and they're not getting contraindicated medications. And then there's another, several other interventions, like the best practice alerts with the drug disease interactions. Mm-hmm. We also changed how levodopa is prescribed in the hospital, in that those hospital schedules, the TID and BID dosing schedules, we took off as an option. It forces them to what people call a custom schedule or a time-based schedule. So you had to pick the times that the medications were being administered. So at least there's some intentionality to that. And ideally, you know, and I think it does work this way, that the providers then, and there's instructions that go along with it as well, would then, you know, need to know what time they should be taking it, and then order those specific times, as opposed to, well, it's three times a day, so we'll do TID. And,
right. you're and how get do they it find every- out about those times? Just from the caregiver or the patient themselves, or?
Yes, so it's often documented. You know, specifically, there are a number of different medication reconciliation processes when a patient's admitted. Mm-hmm. But you have to ask the right questions too, right? So, you know, if they're taking it three times a day and that's what's written down and they record TID, but then you say, well, what are the exact times? Mm-hmm. And it's something different than what the hospital would do if you put in that order, then hopefully that will get ordered.
Oh, I see.
If not, our team will catch it.
Okay.
And we'll see that there's a difference between what was ordered and what the patient was taking at home. Mm-hmm. We'll also see if they're starting to have problems because they're being over-medicated mm-hmm. or under-medicated in the record and also intervene based on that too. If there's some symptoms that cropped up that need to be managed, is there dyskinesia that's taking off? Is there psychosis that wasn't there that is now?
Mm-hmm.
Is the patient very slow and stiff or having swallowing problems? Our team is gonna pick up on some of those kinds of things when the medications are off.
Okay.
So we even analyzed our first 6 months of data, part of it, and the final 6 months will finish at the end of June.
Okay.
And with that, we're starting to see some good signals. We're starting to see that timing of meds is much better.
Mm-hmm.
It's never going to be perfect, mm-hmm. and even contraindicated medications is never going to be perfect. But contraindicated meds, if you look in the literature, it's about 1 in 5. It's about 20% of patients when they're hospitalized get a contraindicated medication. And we started out, even our baseline sample was under 10% before intervention.
Mm-hmm.
But we've taken that, and per hospitalization, we've reduced it another 7% of hospitalizations, but even more so, the number of doses that people get, at least in our first 6 months, per hospitalization was reduced by 71%.
Wow.
So we're having a big impact, and particularly on the prolonged use of contraindicated meds and some impact up front on whether they get something ordered at all. And that's the challenge, is you can get the intervention to be more and more proactive. It's that call in the middle of the night that somebody has, psychosis in the hospital at midnight.
Mm-hmm.
They just got some pain medications that might be stimulating that, or they have an infection or something that also puts people at risk. And these are things that happens all the time in the hospital, right?
Yeah.
People are sick. Those kinds of illnesses will put you at risk for these kinds of things. And people will reach for antipsychotics that are, typically going to make Parkinson's worse.
Mm-hmm.
So we're preventing that, and we're stopping it.
I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Because
we can think of several instances where...
Even people at the gym.
Yeah, as I was saying, a couple of people at the gym
that have had bad experiences.
It happens all the time,
yeah.
Unfortunately.
So my question, because I've seen it again with people at the gym, but like why is the mortality rate, why does that go up with like contradicting medicines? Is it because of like I can never say that word. Asphyxiation. Thanks. Yeah.
So the contraindicated meds that we're talking about are typically ones that block dopamine.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And obviously dopamine is important for Parkinson's.
Uh-huh.
And if you don't make enough dopamine in the first place, and your medications that you're reliant on are dopamine-based medications, if you take something that blocks that, your meds don't work at all. And not only that, your own dopamine, whatever you have left, isn't doing anything.
Mm-hmm.
You can take somebody who doesn't have Parkinson's and make them look like they have Parkinson's with these same classes of medications, mm-hmm. just by blocking the dopamine that the brain makes on its own. When you have more severe symptoms, you can't move, you're stiff, you can't swallow, which is critically important. And you may not have good strength. It may be hard to breathe if you're already weak. And so what we see is people that are having swallowing problems, and they have aspiration pneumonia. And then the aspiration pneumonia makes the Parkinson's worse.
Mm-hmm.
And then their swallowing is even worse.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're in critical care. And anytime something like this happens, there can be a downward spiral where one thing leads to another.
Yeah.
If you're not moving very well and you're in critical care, then you can get bed sores. And those bed sores become other sources of infection.
Mm-hmm.
Or you get clots in your legs and you have deep vein thrombosis. Those clots then cause strokes and pulmonary emboli, which by themselves can be fatal. So all these things can kind of snowball.
Yeah.
People that are mobile and in fairly good health aren't going to have problems. But once you start shifting health in the other direction, other things can happen. And we're talking about people that are already in the hospital for some reason,
mm-hmm.
and probably have, potentially significant medical problems going on, which brought them there in the first place.
Right. That's, go ahead.
Yeah, that's the same thing that Dr. Patel had told us there, is that, the nurse is calling the doctor saying, hey, Brian has pain. Is it okay if we give him X, Y, Z? He's on call. He's like, yeah, go ahead. He may not even know that I have Parkinson's. you know, it's a educating
right.
the nursing and stuff like that goes a long way too.
So with the research that you're doing to show the reduction in hospital stays, or you know whatever the analytics that you're going to target, are you then looking to, you know, publish that so that other hospital systems do the same?
We are. So
I mean, can you make it, can somebody make it mandatory at all, like the National Association of Neurology, or I don't know, whatever. Like, how does that happen?
We just had that thing passed in Congress, right?
Oh yeah, the world or National Parkinson's. Yeah, National Parkinson's
Act. Yeah, so that's for research support, which is really important. And this is how these kinds of things get done, mm-hmm. right? And this is, you know, research on the implementation of clinical care, mm-hmm. Which, you know, it's so obvious, I think, to everybody, you know, here at this table that this is a problem, mm-hmm. and there's some clear solutions, but you have to do it, and you have to get the data and show that it's important. So that data itself is powerful, because that will help us support, you know, with our leadership, that this is an important program to support. It'll help other people at other institutions do the same thing. And, you know, really the Parkinson's Foundation is doing a fantastic job at driving this initiative as well. And we work very closely hand in hand with them. So they've funded some of our research. They're a collaborator in what we're doing. But at the same time, they also have this year a learning collaborative that they put together, which is getting, it's, you know, like 80 or so different healthcare organizations are participating in quarterly meetings and discussions about these topics, with us and many others presenting data from what we're doing and everybody sharing knowledge.
That's awesome.
But I think it's that kind of effort then that gets the word out and helps people get these programs going. I think at the other hospitals, the questions, how did you do that? Not how did you physically do it, but how did you get permission and the time to do what you're doing, because it's challenging. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make this self-sustainable so that these kinds of processes can be supported by any institution, mm-hmm. and potentially would be mandatory, at least, you know, when you start to look at how the electronic health record is set up. That's an easy thing to have some basic safety mechanisms
right.
That are specific to this disease state mm-hmm. For people. And that doesn't take much of an effort, but it has to be built, and then it has to be implemented. Yeah. And each hospital is very different in that sense.
So if the data shows shorter hospital stays and stuff like that, the insurance companies are going to get on board with it really
right.
quick.
Right. There is value that is being created.
Yeah.
And that value then, you know, supports and can support these kinds of efforts.
Are you guys connecting with any of the payers on this, like having conversations about and showing, the, like you said, like the value and?
Not at this point, but I think that that is on a couple different levels a hope with the data, what it can do, because, you know, there's lots of different mechanisms for reimbursement for yeah. healthcare processes, and there are mechanisms for supporting chronic disease surveillance in the outpatient setting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very reasonable to support this kind of effort on the inpatient setting.
Yeah.
Our providers do get consulted on some of these more complicated cases. So there's billing revenue that's generated, but generally there's a lot of effort that goes on that's not reimbursable
mm-hmm.
in the current setting. And that's where we're trying to bridge that gap so yeah. that, you know, that in one way or another, the healthcare system is encouraged to do this.
Yeah.
And in other aspects, when you have the data, there is encouragement in that healthcare systems are discouraged from having long lengths of stay,
right.
from having you know, higher mortality indexes. So there's all that there. And it's a matter of connecting the dots on all of this.
Yeah.
Yeah, having stopping somebody from coming back in.
Like yeah, they don't 90. Want to see you again.
No, they don't. Nobody does. So it's hard.
So I know that this is being done at your main campus, and it's, you know, will hopefully be then at all Cleveland clinics. But there's tons of hospitals out there, and it's not going to happen overnight. What can, like, caregivers or even just patients themselves, if, you know, depending on the severity of their disease, how can they advocate, you know, for themselves or for their loved ones? if they have to go to a hospital and, you know, they're concerned about any medical administration, like how can they best handle it?
Yeah, absolutely. So from the patient and the family perspective, I think, reaching out for some of the resources that are available to empower you to educate the healthcare providers that are taking care of you is the best way to go.
The thing that I've heard the most about is, I mean, because we've been on and we've shared the new hospital book that the Parkinson's mm-hmm. Foundation put together and the Aware and Care kit and things like that, which the book has been fantastic. I love the new book that they just put out for everybody because it's like it has those worksheets you mm-hmm. can pull out and take with you. But so many people that have been to the hospital have told me, they're like, you know, it's fine. Like I'll tell like one nurse or whomever, but then there's like five different nurses that have come through, especially overnight. Like, how do you keep up with, you know, having to educate every single person that comes through? Like, what's the best, is there like protocol of something again that you can do to advocate for yourself with these medications so that like, even in the middle of the night, the person knows when it's not in the system yet?
Well, I think, I mean, those education kits are really get to that problem. And you speak to the challenge, which is that, healthcare systems in general don't have long-term memory when the providers are constantly changing.
Yeah.
And a shift ends and another one starts. So if that nurse signs out that information to the following nurse, that information gets passed on if it's documented in the chart. Getting from there, I think that's the best place to start for somebody advocating for themselves or their family member. But what the healthcare systems need to do is to bring this further, to be able to have some proactive mechanisms mm-hmm. and awareness mm-hmm. of their own in the way we are, and making that level of awareness and have procedures in place where the electronic health record may have flags, for example.
Yeah.
And some of these, with Epic, as an example, we've worked with an Epic subcommittee to create alerts within the mm-hmm. the record so that you can see who has Parkinson's, and when they do have Parkinson's, that there are certain alerts about their care that people should be aware of. Mm-hmm. And a big one is getting their meds on time and making sure they get the appropriate medication. So when you start to have those kinds of things that are built into the electronics and the electronic record, I think that will help a lot more people a lot faster and support. You're still going to have people who don't always know. Yeah. And it is a very complicated disorder in that sense. But when you have the patients and the family advocating for themselves, and they go back to their record and they can see then the flag shows up and they see the same information, which they may not have paid attention to, but now it's there and they're hearing it. Now it's very understandable and believable now, and they're going to take it a lot more serious and maybe get some advice on how to implement that plan for that patient in that facility.
Okay. Awesome. This was great. Thank you so
really
much.
It's my pleasure.
I really, really appreciate you coming in and doing all the work that you're doing. This is just amazing.
Well, we feel like it's really important, so we do it. You know,
it definitely is. and without you doing things like this, you know, I don't know how this would get done. Because when we first found out about it, it was like, okay, what can we do? And I have some connections, but not that many.
Well, doing stuff. You need to get the word out, but
absolutely.
One way is if you have a microphone.
I know, and I have a loud voice.
Turn it on and speak out loud, right?
A lot of people listening. But thank you again very much for coming.
Thank you.
In our last 30 seconds, I will leave you all with this. Change is on the way, and thanks to Dr. Walter and his team at the Cleveland Clinic and those at Epic and the Parkinson's Foundation. For all of the work that they're doing right now to change the way that we receive medication in the hospital system. So there's more to come, so be patient. But in the meantime, make sure that you're always advocating for yourself. If you're a caregiver, make sure that you're advocating for your loved one in whatever setting that you're brought into. So with that, we'll see you next time. The Secret Life of Parkinson's is produced by Melissa Carlson and Steve Brandenburg. To contact us, email info@thesecretlifeofpd.org. The Secret Life of Parkinson's is not responsible or liable for any medical advice, diagnosis, course of treatment, or any other information obtained through this podcast. The information provided by The Secret Life of Parkinson's is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you heard on this podcast. You are encouraged to consult a physician for a definitive diagnosis.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.